welcome back to another episode of Quill Etc. Today I'm with Freya India. Freya India is a writer living in the UK. She's also a Quillette contributor, and she has her own Substack called Girls. Freya's written a really interesting piece for Quillette, and it's called Stop Opening Up About Your Mental Health Online. It's a really interesting piece that's very relevant to the younger generations, I think in particular women.
Yeah, I do think, as you've said before, there is a kind of tendency among women to, I guess it's a natural thing to kind of talk through our emotions and kind of, you know, if we feel stressed, that's how we handle it. We talk to each other. And then I think what's happened is you take that natural tendency and then you take a kind of lonely, screen addicted generation, and they tend to do all of their opening up online. And it is predominantly women. If you go on like the mental health hashtag, it's like women giving these really kind of personal stories about their anxiety, or even more like, you know, like their split personality disorders or their like PPD, like really kind of intense mental health struggles. Doesn't seem to be the same for men. So it must be kind of a natural tendency.
Yeah, just the way women interact in girls groups, we bond a lot by sharing intimate details about our lives, by sharing our vulnerabilities. It seems like, from what I can see, men don't do that as much necessarily. So
I think we are more interested in other people's lives. So we're definitely like rewarding that behavior by watching it and liking it and, you know, leaving loads of comments and being interested, and probably as well compassionate. I think a lot of like young women, you know, feel empathy for each other, and so we're like, oh, please open up, please share. But kind of the point of the piece was to say this is kind of swinging now too far the other way, where we're kind of pushing each other and being pushed sometimes by these companies to open up and open up. And sometimes that leaves you in a more vulnerable position, which I think, you know, young women aren't hearing that warning from anyone.
Yeah. So was there something in particular that made you write this piece, like the last straw that you're like, oh my God, I need to write about this? Or is it something you've noticed for a while?
Do you know what? It was a company. So there's a company, I think, is it? It might have been Talkspace. It was one of the like mental health companies. And I got an email from them saying it's Time to Talk Week in the UK. And then they had like a list of options of how to talk. So some of them were like, you know, chat to your friends and family, which is like great. And then other things were like, oh, you can share the hashtag. And then the last one was like, open up on social media. So share your story. And I thought like, oh, I've just seen so many of these companies like explicitly telling people to open up online, obviously because it benefits their platforms. So I'd also seen, I don't know if you know, do you know the guy from Love Island, the doctor?
I saw him in your piece, but is he a real doctor?
I think he was.
Or is he like doctor of philosophy or doctor of...
Yeah, I don't actually know. But he's very, very much kind of pro opening up about your mental health and your mental health medication.
Dr. Alex George, for those interested, he's mentioned in Freya's piece.
So he did this hashtag post your pill, which is basically like getting young fans to share their mental health medication every month, so like the first day of every month, and he's like, oh, you know, it will fight the stigma and it's really good to start discussion. And I just think you're not thinking of the individual child or like teenager, like how is it going to affect them? Are they going to want it there forever that they took this medication? Is it great for everyone they know that they take it? Not because they should be ashamed, but just because, you know, I think they're owed some privacy around something like that. But there seems to just be no kind of caveats from these companies, like, you know, obviously keep things private if they're sensitive. There's nothing like that. It's just you will feel better if you tell as many people online as possible, and you will... It's almost like now the pressure is to be an activist by sharing your personal story, which I think is too much pressure on young people. So it was just like the last straw was another company that I was like, oh, not another one.
Yeah, and there are perverse incentives, right? Like they want you to keep, they want you to stay on the site, on the social media site, and be engaging more and posting more. Yeah. And then, I mean, this is maybe a little bit conspiratorial, but do you think that like the pharmaceutical industry or something, obviously they're benefiting if, you know, people are talking more about the medications they're using and maybe promoting them more.
Especially the pro-medication campaigns. They're just like marketing strategies. Like they are so suspicious. Like it will be these mental health companies will then kind of pay influencers to talk about their medication, or they'll want to start a hashtag about the specific medication. And if you just read into it, it's like, okay, they're talking about destigmatizing that pill. But destigmatizing often means like expanding the amount of people that would need that pill, the amount of reasons why you should take it. So if you listen to some of these kind of influencers or campaigns, they have very, very vague reasons now. So it will be like, you know, I take this pill to feel confident, or to feel, you know, it gives me a boost or something. So it's gone from like a very serious medication, which most of these mental health drugs are, to like a little lifestyle booster.
Lifestyle hack.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I definitely think the pharmaceutical industry is behind a lot of this. You know, I wouldn't be surprised, I don't know this, but I wouldn't be surprised if like Dr. Alex is funded by the pharmaceutical company. You know, I'm very suspicious of it. But if you hear the way kind of young women talk about medication, it's like they're under the influence of a pharma. They've been so kind of convinced that they're almost doing the marketing for that industry by just promoting it and glamorizing it. But I think, you know, that's just from years and years of conditioning around it.
And it seems to me that, you know, the culture we're in at the moment, it's actually a power move to be a victim. And if you've got some sort of illness or ailment or something special about you, that's sort of like social cred. And I think when people really promote it, like, I wonder if half of these people actually do have the mental health issues they say they have, or if it's just some sort of a virtue signal.
Yeah, well, you can see that if you look on, like, again, like mental health TikTok or whatever. It's not just people opening up about their medication or their problems. It's like a real, like, the only word for it is like fetishization, glamorization of it, where it's like they're wearing t-shirts with like Lexapro on it, or they've got like a Prozac phone case, or the way they talk about, they're like giggling like it's really fun and quirky. And it's like, I do get it. Like, if you were really struggling, you kind of want to make it lighthearted to get through it. But if you kind of like step back and look at these posts, it's like these drugs are extremely powerful. Like, they have serious side effects. They're not trivial. And to see young women kind of almost make their identity out of the medication, let alone the mental illness, it's just crazy. It just makes you think, you know, this hasn't been really successful mental health campaigns. It's been like a really successful marketing campaign.
Yeah, because as you wrote about, like, anxiety and depression is growing, especially among young generations and young women. All this talking and destigmatizing we're doing, is it actually working? Because it seems like people are just getting more mentally ill.
Yeah, well, I think what tends to happen is once you've kind of identified yourself with something and you've documented it, there is just more pressure to keep identifying with it. So if you, I don't know, I see some of these young women and I feel for them because they're talking about something real. So they'll be talking about like crippling social anxiety. They're explaining it and it's obviously something that's affecting them, which I would say affects most like 15, 16 year olds. But then they're like documenting it for everybody. So for example, there's like this young woman on TikTok who does, she films herself like getting out of her comfort zone and doing things to like face her social anxiety. So she'll like order in a restaurant and film it and be like shaking or whatever. And it's like, I feel for her, but it's like what if you do overcome it and you do get really confident and you're 5 years down the line, you've kind of made, you know, she's getting millions of views. And I just worry at that age, you don't know the long term, you don't have a long term vision. So I think that's what we're not warning young people of enough.
Yeah, like what's the incentive to get better when you've built your following and your whole brand on being chronically ill or mentally ill? Or...
And it's kind of like, as I said in the piece, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy, but now you've got the kind of algorithms behind it and the software engineering, which is kind of ensuring that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if you feel a little bit anxious and you post about it and then you get further into that community and you get served more stuff, then you're going to become more anxious. So I just think it traps people in a cycle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't tell them enough about it.
And what do you think the solution is for this?
Well, I think my solution in general is just to document less of your life online. Mm-hmm. Because I think what people think is, you know, social media is like this highlight reel and everyone's posting their best moments. So I'll kind of be vulnerable and post my real self. And if we all do that, then we've got like an accurate picture of life. Whereas I don't think that's the solution, is to like start revealing all of this personal information. I think in general, especially young women, need to kind of hear the message of, you don't need to constantly post everything. Like you don't really need to share something so personal and emotional. And I think a lot of girls feel pressure to do that because they think, you know, it's not real if I'm not sharing it, or I need to show that I'm special in some way by sharing how I struggle. And yeah, there's kind of no, obviously there's no influencers telling them not to post. So I think it's a missing message.
And yeah, this is something I wrote about as I sent you. And it came from a very personal place, which is that I have a natural tendency to overshare. You know, I got Facebook when I was in like year six, which in Australia is like 12 years old. And then I got, and then I got Tumblr, and then I got Instagram, and now I'm on Twitter. And pretty much my whole adolescence has been documented online, essentially. Like, I've been posting photos and how I'm feeling and my thoughts and what I'm doing and what I'm reading. And I don't regret it as such, but I think that as I've gotten older, I've been a bit more conservative with what I'm posting, not just for safety reasons. I guess it's about privacy, but it's about something like, something sacred that I want to preserve.
It kind of cheapens it in a way. Like, if you're, I tried to kind of write about this, it's like, I feel like if you have, say, a relationship you really cherish, or like you finally have something in your life that's really meaningful, like blasting it all over social media then kind of loses its appeal, because you're like, oh, this is my kind of special thing that I want to protect. But yeah, I think there's a lot of people kind of, especially from my generation, who are getting to kind of my age, like their early 20s, mid 20s, and starting to realize, okay, not like you said, not necessarily with regret, but just like, I can't continue doing this as my life gets more serious. But then you kind of see some, it's not just like our generations, it's like I wrote recently about influencer parents. So these parents obsessively document their children. And they're some of the worst. I actually think a lot of younger people are already kind of thinking, okay, I don't want to document my child. I'm not going to put them online. You see some kind of like older generations just putting all of their kids' information online, seeming to have no idea of the consequences of that. It's kind of scary.
And yeah, Claire wrote about this for The Australian last week about how so many schools, at least in Australia, I'm not sure about the UK, but many schools, especially private schools, are creating Instagram pages for the school. And her argument is, why is that necessary? And it's just opening up children to the risk of, you know, pedophiles online. Because I'm not sure if if you've looked into this much, but I came across it by accident, which is terrible. But there's a lot of really, there are child predators on Instagram.
It's even scarier now because of like deepfake AI.
Mm.
I mean, and this is just like terrible to talk about, but it's like if you put your child on social media, even if mm-hmm. the photo is innocent, mm-hmm. so the child's just like, you know, in a family picture, they can take the face of the child and superimpose it into something, expose it and share it. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff like if I've seen kind of young children doing like dances on TikTok and things, and the parents film it and they think it's sweet. But there was a whole article in like, I think it was the Rolling Stone, saying that people are taking TikToks of young children and putting them on platforms like Pornhub. And the parents just have no clue that that can happen. So my position on it now is just like, don't be sharing photos of your child online at all.
And, you know, there's always a risk. It's like, you know, when you go to the beach and you see that some people let their toddlers run around naked or, you know, without a top on or something like that. And I always thought, oh, would I do that with my children? What about if there are creeps around? You know, you can never control how someone's going to look at either nor you nor your child. You know, you can't control how people, we know as women too, you can be dressed modestly or however, but men can still sexualize you. So you can't fully control, you know, everything, but there are definitely risks that can be avoided by changing your behavior.
The main way to control it would just be to post less. It's like the only thing we can do, because I think of things like the deep fake technology, and it's kind of hard to imagine how we're going to stop that or regulate it or get hold of it now that it's out. So like it does then come down to personal kind of agency and having to be like strict about it. So I just think like, a lot of parents think it's kind of cute and fun to share. And I think there needs to be a little bit more warning now of actually, you know, technology is ramping up and there are so many people out there that can exploit those photos.
And have you personally changed the way you use social media over the years?
Yeah, so I deleted like all my social media in 2020, pretty much because of lockdown. I was like, I'm literally sat doing nothing. And like, I think it was as lockdown was opening up, so I was starting to see people go out and I was remembering how bad it was to constantly compare myself to what everyone else was doing. Because I'd kind of had a break for a bit because everyone was locked down. So I remember thinking like, this is just not worth it in the same way that it used to be. So I deleted everything apart from like Twitter to share writing. And the main thing I feel is like the relief of like, if I go to an event or something, there's not that thing in the back of my mind, like I need to get a photo or I need to kind of find good lighting or I've got an outfit on that I need to kind of capture. Like that's a real like thing, like a pressure.
Speaking of, we got a great photo at the Quillette Social in London and it's never been posted anywhere. It's just like sitting on my, I don't know whose camera it's on. Maybe it's on Claire's, but yeah.
You see, that's great when there's a photographer there because then the pressure's off for you.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of like, you know, like young women, they go to something, some event, and the entire night is like consumed by getting that good photo. Like I've seen that. I've done it myself and I've felt it with friends where it's like, we need to capture this moment perfectly.
Yeah. And if they can't get the perfect photo, they're in a shitty mood.
Yes. Yeah. It's like, oh, it was not worth it. People don't realize, because they've grown up with it, they don't see that as an added unnecessary pressure. So when you take it out, it's like, oh, that was actually adding a lot of stress to my day, and it's gone. Whereas I think like loads of girls feel that pressure and think, oh, this is just life, you know, we have to document everything as we go. And it's like, that's not, you don't have to live like that if you don't want to. People don't realize, because they've grown up with it, they don't see that as an added unnecessary pressure. So when you take it out, it's like, oh, that was actually adding a lot of stress to my day, and it's gone. Whereas I think like loads of girls feel that pressure and think, oh, this is just life. You know, we have to document everything as we go. And it's like, that's not, you don't have to live like that if you don't want to.
And do you ever get FOMO, fear of missing out?
No, I think, I mean, I guess I get like curious of what other people are doing. I definitely notice that, but I think it also kind of shows you who your friends are, because if you like delete Instagram and Facebook, a lot of people don't remember who you are. Like they don't remember to check in, or like they won't remember your birthday or anything. But then you'll get like the select few that do, and it's like really separates out, okay, who is just my friend online and who is actually, you know, like if I get a random message saying, oh, I haven't seen what you've been doing in ages, what you're up to, is so much more meaningful than someone like watching my Instagram story.
Hey everyone, it's Zoe here. We'll be back to the episode in just a moment after this short commercial break. I want to tell you about a really interesting event that's taking place in Brooklyn on the 3rd and 4th of May. It's called Dissident Dialogues, and it's an event where some of the leading thinkers of our time will be speaking. That includes Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, John McWhorter, and many more. You'll also get to meet Quillette senior editor, John Kay, who'll be there along with Kathleen Stock, Diana Fleischman, Mary Harrington, and many more. There will be much discussion of culture wars, Christianity, Islam, atheism, and everything in between. If you're into intellectual honesty, curiosity, and the desire for truth, Dissident Dialogues is the place for you. It's a place for dangerous ideas. If you want to grab some tickets, you can do so at dissidentdialogues.org and be part of the conversation. Now back to the podcast. I've been thinking a lot about this. It's going on, so I'm 28. So yeah, I finished high school about a decade ago. Mm-hmm. And still to this day, there are lots of people who follow me or I follow them on Instagram, and they're just like some random person I met at a bar in Italy when I was backpacking when I was 19, or someone I went on a school camp with. And firstly, it's like, why are we still in contact? It's not, it's such a weird time to be alive, because in our parents' generation or before that, you'd just forget about that person and you wouldn't have constant updates about their life. And I think the industry I'm working in, which involves like talking about really at times like controversial issues or political opinions, I think people might just see my work and my opinions and they don't remember that I was a normal chick they met at a bar in Italy or they went to school with, but it looks like I'm constantly like opinionated person, which maybe I am, but
I had the similar thing, because it's like I kind of fell into this world of writing and everything, and then it's like it's very different to what I was doing before, where I was just had a certain set of friends in a certain place. And I do think when your life changes, or you kind of change career, or you enter a new career, I think if there's a natural thing to kind of move on from people and places. But now, like you said, you're kind of stuck with everyone's updates, and it's kind of rude to just unfollow someone if you've not fallen out. So you feel like you kind of have to see what they're doing and they have to see what you're doing. And I think about it a lot with things like relationships as well. Like previous generations would break up and can kind of cut clean, whereas like now you think of like a young woman who goes through a terrible breakup, she's got instant access to what her ex-boyfriend's doing if she wants to kind of look. And the same with like friends that you break up with, you can just immediately go see what they're doing. I think there's like all of these little things that we think are normal about social media, and then when you actually think about them, they're really quite strange and add pressure that just doesn't need to be there.
Well, you've inspired me to maybe curb my rampant social media use. You know, I've attempted that. I've attempted detoxes before.
But do you feel like it makes you feel bad? Because some people don't seem to have a negative impact.
I go through periods where it can, but I think too, as I've gotten older, I'm more secure in who I am. And I'm sort of, and I've accepted that not everyone's going to like me. In fact, a lot of people are going to dislike me because of the things I'm saying or where I work. I can't control it and sort of just like deal with it. And yeah.
Well, I think that's a good point, because it's kind of why the problem is like adolescent girls in puberty who are on social media, because they don't have that sense of self. Like, you gain that sense of self in like your mid late 20s, ever. Whereas if you take like a 15-year-old, like when you're a 15-year-old girl, you just are so susceptible to other people's opinions, who likes you, who doesn't. And so I don't actually think it's terrible for, like, if you're 28 to be on social media and you know who you are and you know what you want to share. But it's like if you're, 15, it's very different.
And I think I wouldn't have gotten that far into like social justice ideology if it weren't for social media. I think actually I definitely wouldn't have. And the way I got into it was through Tumblr. Do you know about Tumblr? So
I think but I remember Tumblr being like mental health crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, it was rife with pro Anna stuff, so yeah. Anorexia content, eating disorder content. It was rife with a lot of the nascent sort of mental health discussion. But it was also rife with that's how I learned about socialism and Marxism and veganism and feminism and all of the isms. So I got into that when I was 14 or 15, a little bit younger than other people who I think got into it with Instagram in their early 20s, at least in my school cohort. Yeah. And I feel like I've sort of passed through that stage, and a lot of them are recently getting new to it, getting into it now.
How did
because it's so popular.
Like, break out of the social justice, if you've seen it all on Tumblr, what changed?
I think all of the people around me started to get more into it, and it seemed to, I was part of a lot of these feminist groups and other sort of political groups, and I saw the advent of trigger warnings, and I just thought, why can't we talk about these issues? Why are you so sensitive that I have to put a trigger warning for food? I'm sorry you have an issue with food, but do I really need to change my behavior just to suit you? And I think it's how the Jordan Peterson issue kicked off. He was like, that's fine that you're who you are, but why do I have to change my behavior to suit you? And I think maybe that's a natural personality trait that I have. Yeah. I don't like to be told what to do. Were you ever into it?
No. Was I? No, not really. I think I was kind of apolitical. Mm-hmm. So I would kind of hear a lot of it and maybe agree in conversation, but never passionately on the left. But mine, Jordan Peterson was my... would change it all. I just remember watching him. I think it was probably Kathy Newman was the first one I saw.
Me too.
Yeah. And it was just insane. It was I have never heard anyone speak like this. I've never heard anyone challenge something that was self-evident.
So your first reaction was a positive one, because I was really offended.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was firstly, my friend sent it to me. And she was like, oh, can you believe this? This is disgusting, blah, blah, blah. Who is this pig? And I watched it and I had such a visceral, I was literally triggered. I could feel my blood pressure rising and I was sweating and stuff. I was so pissed off about it. But at the same time, I had absolutely nothing to criticize him on.
Which is probably why it triggered you.
And then I think I do have the ability to change my mind when presented with evidence So I started to change my mind, but that was a domino effect. I was like, oh, what else is to be challenged here, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of what I think it was the first, like, it's kind of crazy, but I think it was the first video I'd seen of, like, critical thinking of someone actually kind of saying, no, I disagree with how you're framing this. And then it led to me, like, questioning everything. And now, like, we started the conversation, like, whenever I hear something over and over, like, open up about your mental health, now my brain is immediately like, okay, is that actually true? Is there downsides to that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it does kind of send you on a domino effect of critically looking at everything.
Would you call yourself a conservative?
Yeah, I'd probably say I'm like a socially conservative. I don't view that as like a political party thing. I view it as like a personality thing.
Okay.
I think if you did the kind of Jordan Peterson personality test on me, I would be extremely conservative just from my...
You haven't done it?
No, I haven't done it.
I'm going to guess because it's ocean. So openness to new experience, I would say. I mean, I don't know you that well, but maybe not that open. Maybe that's like drugs, like music, sex, all this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's low.
Yeah, down. Yeah. C is conscientiousness.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm high in that.
Yeah. You write a lot, you work hard. Mm-hmm. Extroversion.
Low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreeableness. This is an interesting one.
No, I'm quite high in agreeableness, but I make a conscious effort to not be. So I think...
Yes, as Jordan says, women should do.
Yeah. But I think I'm so high in agreeableness in my life that in my writing, I'm like extremely disagreeable because it's kind of like a little outlet where I can actually be disagreeable.
Interesting.
What's the last one?
Neuroticism.
Oh, hi.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, I think things like low in openness is caused by my anxiety about what could go wrong. So I think they're kind of like linked, which is why I like write a lot about the mental health trends, is because I can be very like neurotic. I can understand, you know, there's some people who are like, I can't understand anxiety at all. That's not me. Like I can fully empathize with the people sharing what they're sharing, and I can like empathize with neuroticism and like emotional angst, but I just think the way we talk about it is not useful.
Yeah. Do you place a lot of importance on like individual responsibility?
I don't know. I just think that side of the conversation, like that's one part of it, but that part has been completely drowned out. So it's like, I think especially things targeted toward girls and women now, there's no kind of personal responsibility because we're kind of scared to say to women, don't do that, you know, this is not good. And so I feel like if you kind of look at where young women are getting their information or like hearing narratives, it would be from like pop culture or social media or like their universities, where it's tends to be the same message, which is like, you're doing great, you know, any problem is something external. And so it's not that I think, you know, every problem is personal responsibility. I just think the personal responsibility bit has kind of faded.
Yes.
Especially for women. Like, there doesn't seem to be discipline around women anymore. Like, we can't ever say, like, for example, in the piece I say, you know, we always say to men, you should be opening up more. But we would never say to women, you're opening up too much. And I think that's kind of interesting because it's like, why can't we say to women that maybe their behavior could be bad for them?
Yeah.
There seems to be fear around that.
I think it's just this woke ideology essentially of like oppressed oppressor. And if, because women are seen as the more oppressed sex or gender, they're more of a protected species, and like, yeah, women should be protected obviously, and we have vulnerabilities that men don't have, but that's mostly in terms of our physicality. It's not our, you know, capacity to be strong.
I think if, like, I often look at some of these companies, like mental health companies and campaigns, and I don't know why they don't get more like criticism from feminists, because they're so patronizing. There's this website called Hers. I don't know if you've heard of it.
No.
They do like So they do like self-care products. So they do like hair products, skincare, but they also do psychiatric drugs that they can ship to your door. And they kind of use the same language for the hair products and the anxiety medication. And you look at the way they're marketing to women, it is so patronizing. It's like, you know, you need this to feel confident. You need this for any premenstrual symptoms. You should be on like this drug that's like Prozac. They have therapy and they advertise like it's like $99 an hour to help women deal with daily stresses, they call it. It's like, that's so offensive to, because they also have a men's website called Hims, which has like none of this. Theirs is like very practical. It would be like hair loss medication. You go on the women's website and it's like generalized anxiety disorder, like very vague descriptions of depression, like kind of worry or waking up late, and the drugs that we need or the therapy that we need. And it's like, why do we get this idea that women need constant reassurance and intervention? Like, I do think women, you know, especially younger women, have emotional vulnerabilities that are different to men. We deal with it differently, but it seems to be have gone so far now that it's like coddling. And yeah, mental health companies profiting off of that narrative.
What can young women do to really help their mental health, their anxiety, aside from perhaps not using social media so much? What are some things that you think help or have helped you?
You know, I think women need, like men need, to prove to themselves that they are capable and resilient, like just the same. So, you know, I would always encourage things like risky behaviors or slightly dangerous things. So like going out and doing sports, or even things like learning to drive, which young people aren't doing or delaying, you know, getting a Saturday job that's stressful and it like really triggers your social anxiety, but you just do it. So I think encouraging young women to kind of show to themselves in adolescence that they are not fragile, so that as they grow up, they have kind of reminders and evidence behind them to say, okay, actually I faced that and I did that. So I think, yeah, get off screens, do more of those kind of behaviors. Something I try really hard to do, which is like thinking less of yourself in terms of like not constantly thinking about, well, firstly, how you look, because like it's very easy to do that with social media, but also how you're feeling, what you want, what your kind of, again, your triggers are, your traumas are. I feel like there's a lot of pressure to constantly look inwards at yourself. And I think
it's a narcissistic culture.
But it has the kind of opposite impact, because you're just like ruminating about yourself. And I think there's not a message, again, there's not a message to young women saying, think about yourself as least as you can, because it's actually kind of freeing. It seems to be, if you're really struggling, you need to sit and do the work, and you need to think about everything to do with you and what you want. And I think there's like a place for that, but I would also encourage like helping other people, or trying to think, how are other people feeling?
Yeah, I found that, you know, in periods where I'm feeling really down or anxious, just going to the local cafe and chatting with a barista, or calling my parents, or calling someone else, asking them about their problems, gets you out of, a very narcissistic way to be, and it doesn't help to be like that.
Even if you're kind of thinking negatively about yourself, it's still like self-obsession. It's still thinking about you. So I think a lot of these people, young people who are struggling, are like, you know, they're thinking all the time about how like ugly they are, or insecure they are, or anxious they are. And it's still like, for want of a better word, it's self-obsession. It's still ruminating. Again, I think we're scared to tell young women.
I think too, the time I switched, or the moment I switched from seeing myself as a victim to seeing myself as a victor, really changed my whole world. And now when I hear myself getting into that, oh, woe is me, blah, 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 I'm like, ew, Don't be like that, because I hate seeing it in other people. It's very unattractive. We don't admit it, but it is very unattractive, you know.
So how did you change that mindset? Because that's hard.
It was around the time I was living in Spain with my ex, who is Spanish, but our relationship was falling apart and I was very lonely. I didn't know the country. My language wasn't great. And I was feeling very down and very lonely. And I did come across Jordan Peterson and started listening to more of his stuff, hearing, hey, stop being a victim, pull yourself together, really changed my life. And I started to just think more like that and implement little changes into my life. And now maybe I'm very radical with that. Sometimes I fear that I've become a bit too harsh or too, it's not that I lack empathy.
Because I had the same thing with Jordan Peterson again, but it's like, I think that just shows that women do need that as well. Like, I think of all the times I've actually, like, improved myself in my life, it's been from, like, tough love. Like, someone said something to me that's, like, truly been like, okay, I need to change this.
Mm.
Or they've been honest with me. And I think if you ask, like, a lot of adults, you know, what was the best advice you've ever been given, it would probably be like a brutal bit of like, pull yourself together kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think now it's like everyone's kind of so careful with their language and really trying to be as respectful as possible. And so you kind of, for example, that girl who posts her social anxiety on TikTok,
mm-hmm.
the comments will be like, oh my God, you're so brave for like being able to order in a restaurant. Like, you should be so proud. You should like, and it's like, I get where that's coming from because I think anxiety is awful. And if you do a little improvement, it does feel like a massive achievement. But is it good for everyone else to kind of pretend that's normal, to kind of pretend that it's okay that you're 25 and can't order in a restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would want like my dad or someone to say to me, why can't you order in a restaurant?
Yeah,
exactly.
Or if you need reassurance, tell someone you love who you know personally, you know, who knows your vulnerabilities, and get reassurance and love from them, not from millions of strangers.
Yeah, who just are gonna, you know, again, be terrified to, you know, get called out for like being offensive or being too harsh.
Mm-hmm.
But I think young women don't, you know, it's a disservice to us to constantly be coddled and coddle each other. It really is terrible for mental health, I think. And I think people think, oh, you know, like that's really bad for guys, but it's good for girls. And it's like, well,
double standard.
Yeah, like some level for girls maybe of talking to each other, but it's like extreme coddling culture is not good for girls. If anything, it kind of like indulges our already kind of vulnerable tendencies.
Have you read any Camille Paglia?
I haven't. I really need to.
You should. Yeah. I'll send you some stuff. But she really changed me too. And Jordan Peterson and her have a great conversation, actually. Yeah. I think he's quite a fan of her work. I'm just getting through another book of her essays, Sex and American Culture, something like that. Her concept of like Amazonian feminism, she calls it, has really inspired me too, which is seeing woman as strong and in many ways, I think she would say like the dominant sex. I don't think we're the dominant sex. I think we're both, we both need each other, but we're definitely not the subservient sex. We have a lot of power.
Well, I think what happened is you had like the feminists using language like strong women and kind of having these tropes in movies that were maybe like too like forced. And so everyone kind of like backed away from that and is like, okay, you know, women aren't strong like that. And we argue against that. And then it's like, we've gone the other way where we're now like, thinking women are really weak and fragile. And I just think it's not true. I do think we also need purpose like men do. Like we need meaning in our lives. We also need to feel confident. We also need like discipline, all of that. Like, mm-hmm. I love all of those videos of, like, Jordan Peterson or, like, even David Goggins, things like that. Like,
yeah.
It really does. It's the only thing I listen to that actually inspires me. Like, none of this, you know, you're on the right path, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
None of that does anything to me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I have quite, I thought they were masculine, but maybe they're not. Maybe they're just human interests. And yeah, hearing. Unless
very masculine. Pardon? Unless we're both really masculine.
Well, you know, it's crossed my mind that a lot of women in this space have, I don't know what it is, because obviously we're very feminine and we're very, you know, we don't deny that and we don't hate that either.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's, I guess it's just that in this day and age, taking responsibility and discipline is seen as only a masculine thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I don't know if it's, if this is what all women feel or if, like, it's just something in me, but I do feel like I've noticed it with, you know, again, my other friends, if I've given them tough love or if they've received tough love, it does seem to boost them in a way. Like, I don't know anyone that reads these, like, empty cliches, like, you know, you're fine as you are, you're empowered, all of this, and actually feels anything. Like, I think most people see it as empty. But then why is it so popular?
I don't know, but you should write an essay on it and work it out. I'd love to read that. Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really recommend that everyone goes and reads Freya's work on Quillette. There are two essays there, and go check out Freya's Substack, Girls.
Yes,
Girls. Yep. And Freya's on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
Yes, so it's Freya India A on Twitter.
Cool, and I'll link it in the show notes. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.